You know, it occurs to me as a person that feels young but isn't really getting any younger, actually. And it's amazing to me when I think that I have been in the National Federation of the Blind for 16 years. That's a long time. It doesn't seem like that long. And I know Tom Bickford over there would say, that's just a little pittance, you know, you've barely been in here. But it occurred to me when I was putting this convention agenda together that we talk about these three giants. We banter about Dr. Tenbrook and what a brilliant scholar he is, and we talk about Dr. Jernigan, and we talk about Dr. Maurer. And yet it occurred to me that a lot of people who are new to this organization really do not know who these men were and who they are. And so I am delighted to bring you this next panel. This is entitled The Three Giants Who Led Us and Lead Us on the Path of the Life We Want. And here for this panel is Dr. Mark Maurer. He is the immediate past president of the National Federation of the Blind. And then we have Mary Ellen Jernigan, who is the policy advisor to the president of the National Federation of the Blind. And last but certainly not least, a man that I care very deeply about, our national president, Mark Riccobono. Here are these wonderful people for this great panel.
Thank you very much, Madam President. I notice that we have 40 minutes, and I know that you need a couple to close the program here, so we'll step on it. My job is Dr. Tenbrook. As has been said, he was a brilliant man. I never met him. I joined the organization in 1969 when Tom Bickford was, you know, celebrating well over a decade. And Dr. Tenbrook had died the year before. Dr. Tenbrook did some remarkable things, and I could talk about his remarkable work in many ways. He was a writer of constitutional provisions. He earned 5 college degrees. He was head of his department at the University of California at Berkeley. He drafted documents that changed the interpretation of the Constitution of the United States, and I could go into detail about that. When I was in law school in the 1970s, some of his writings were referenced in the constitutional law book I read. I have not read a constitutional law book recently, but I have looked up Dr. Tenbrook's writings in constitutional law that I was using to write some of the arguments that I was using in trying to change the interpretation of some of the minimum wage legislation. And there are dozens or hundreds of references in jurisprudence to the writings of Dr. Tenbrook. In my opinion, however, Dr. Tenbrook did 2 things that are more remarkable than that. First, he was a blind person. He became blind as the result of an accident which occurred in Canada, where he was born. There was a bow and arrow accident. He was 7. He was hit by an arrow that was shot by a little friend of his in the eye, and he lost that eye. And then he became blind from the disease that resulted. His family moved to California and enrolled him at the School for the Blind. And he graduated. He went from that school to the University of California, and he got himself a degree. And then he went to the law school, and he got himself a degree. In the mid-1930s, there was a plan to try to get an organization put together in California. There had been a number of clubs that had been created by Dr. Tenbrook's teacher And those were intended to help inspire people to believe that there was something that they might do with their lives. And those clubs came together into what came to be known as the California Council of the Blind. And there were a number of folks who wanted to run that organization. They were people in the social work group who thought that if there was going to be an organization to represent the blind, then there ought to be somebody who knew about the social effect of blind people, and they were going to help manage this organization. Dr. Tenbrook came with his friends to that meeting and took it over. It didn't belong to anybody else anymore. It belonged to Dr. Tenbrook and his friends. And then they started thinking about national policies that were being created. The Books for the Blind program came into being in the 1930s. The Randolph-Shepard Act was adopted in the 1930s. The Social Security Act was adopted in 1935. Then the Wagner-O'Day Act, which supported workshops, was adopted in the 1930s. So many laws came about in the 1930s. National legislation was being adopted. And Dr. Tenbrook looked at this and he said, we have to solve the problem of how to meet the demands that are being created in Washington. We have to have a national organization. And in 1940, we got the National Federation of the Blind in a meeting with, as they, you know, 16 people who gathered together in Wilkes-Barre, Pennsylvania. And Dr. Tenbrook came to that meeting and he addressed the meeting. Now, what he said was remarkable. Part of it goes like this. Ladies and gentlemen, I come before you tonight in the first place to say that so far as the blind are concerned, the Social Security Act has not only failed to attain its plainly expressed goals, but it has been used as a weapon to compel the states to treat their blind in a more niggardly fashion. And I come before you in the second place to say, to proclaim to the wide world that the reason for this failure and the wide wielder of this weapon against you has been the Social Security Board at Washington, proceeding in profound ignorance of the problems of the class with which it has dealt, moved by an intolerable authoritarian ignorance. The Social Security Board at Washington has constituted itself a supreme tribunal to judge whether the states are treating their blind badly enough. If they are not, these administrative despots in the nation's capital apply compulsion by way of open threats and subversive action. So damaging have the activities of this board become that it represents the greatest single menace to the welfare of the blind now in existence. Our salvation depends upon our ability to confine its operations within the limits of the law. Its unauthorized exercise of discretionary power must be terminated. This can only be accomplished by a militant, aggressive, group-conscious national organization of the blind. By this means, we may diminish the board's arrogance if we cannot reduce its ignorance. It's part of what Dr. Tenbrook said. It wasn't up to somebody else. It belongs to us. He caused this organization to come together, and he caused the fighting spirit to be established. That, in my opinion, is the first remarkable thing he did. One of the most remarkable in the history of the world, because until that time, although there were small organizations here and there, there wasn't any national power prepared to stand up for the rights of the blind against anybody, including the entire national government in Washington. What's the second thing he did that I find most remarkable? He hunted up somebody to carry it on. He found a human being and inspired that person to such a degree that human being changed the lives of hundreds of thousands, maybe millions of blind people in the United States and around the world in the last half of the 20th century, and caused me to want to do some of the same. Dr. Tenbrook found Dr. Jernigan and made him want to change the world. That was great. Well, we started with 40 minutes and we now have 31. Madam President, that's my beginning.
And a very fine beginning it was, sir. Please pass that FM system to Mrs. Jernigan, if you might, because Mrs. Jernigan is our next speaker. And I think Dr. Maurer just beautifully let Mrs. Jernigan get into her speech about Dr. Jernigan. Here is Mary Ellen Jernigan.
If Kenneth Jernigan were living, he would have been 88 last Thursday. I know that some of you knew him very well, and I also know that some of you knew him in person, not at all. So I'm going to talk some about history, but I want to start with something about what we're doing today. And it's the thing we've been talking about all day long. We've worked this year very hard on what we call branding, and we've come up with some words, and we've come up with a one-minute message. There are three sentences in that one-minute message, and it's easy for us as we start reciting those sentences over and over to begin to recite them kind of mindlessly, sort of like we're saying, twinkle, twinkle, little star, how I wonder what you are. And we don't think about what they mean. So I'm going to read only the first sentence of that one-minute message, slowly and carefully. And there's one word in it that I want us to focus on. All right, the first sentence of our one-minute message. The National Federation of the Blind knows that blindness is not the characteristic that defines you or your future. The word I want us to think about is knows. It doesn't say we think, it doesn't say we believe, it doesn't say we hope. It says we know. Okay, and that's where we have to look a little bit at history. How did we come to know that blindness is not the characteristic that defines you or your future? Well, we've been working at it for 75 years, and a lot of people have been working on it. But I think it's fair to say that one hugely important contributing factor is the life and work of Kenneth Jernigan. At the time of his birth, in 1926, on a farm in Middle Tennessee, nearly anyone who had uttered our one-minute message would have been thought to have lost touch with reality. And Kenneth Jernigan lived his early years in a culture that totally reinforced that notion. It was an isolated existence in a four-room house on a gravel road. It was an unusual thing, even for an automobile to drive by. There was no indoor plumbing, no electricity, no radios, no telephones, no newspapers. His parents were good people, and they loved him. But they had no clue what to do with a blind child. Sound familiar? Nobody in the neighborhood had never known a blind person. His parents feared for his safety. Mostly, that meant that he was forbidden to leave the porch. His mother even told his older brother Lloyd, time after time, that after she and his father were gone, it would be his responsibility always to care for Kenneth. The isolation of his childhood years gave Kenneth Jernigan time to do a lot of thinking. He was determined not to spend the rest of his life as a prisoner on the porch of that four-room farm home, or as a ward of his older brother Lloyd. At six, he went to the School for the Blind in Nashville. This will surprise you. He got an F in Braille that first quarter. But that was only because he had had to wait until January to start school, because he was not yet six at the time in September when all the other classmates had started. But he quickly caught up. Soon he realized that going... Here, I'll hold it, it's easier. Soon he realized that going to college would be his ticket off the farm. From that point on, he read every Braille and audio book he could get his hands on. When he was a senior in high school, he had an experience that shaped not only his own life, but the lives of blind individuals for generations to come. Here is how he describes that pivotal experience. In 1945, I had my first contact with a rehabilitation official. A counselor came to the School for the Blind, and he and I sat down for a chat. When we got past the niceties, the counselor asked me what I wanted to major in when I went to college. I told him I wanted to be a lawyer. He replied by asking me to tell him three or four things I might like to do. I told him I didn't need to tell him three or four. I wanted to be a lawyer. Now, he was not an unkind man, but what he said was clear. I could be a lawyer and pay for it myself, or I could be something else, and the rehabilitation agency would help pay. Since I didn't have the money, I went to college and was something else. The counselor undoubtedly thought he was acting in my best interest, but I know now that he was wrong. The something else, as far as college was concerned, turned out to be degrees in English literature and history and a job offer to become a professor at a Midwestern college. But in the bigger picture, the something else quite directly relates to today's one-minute message. Here is what happened. Although the college professorship was tempting, he did not accept it. Instead, he took a job that he was offered to teach English at the Tennessee School for the Blind. I suspect that that misguided rehabilitation counselor never knew the immense gift he gave to future generations of blind people when he told a brash teenager that he couldn't study law. For his action had helped Kenneth Jernigan come to the decision to work to create a world where blind people can live the lives they want, not the world of low expectations of the rehab counselor, and not the world where the blind person settles for something else. He met Jacobus Tenbroek in 1952 when he attended his first national convention. Soon he moved to California, spent the next 6 years working closely with Dr. Tenbroek. During those years, he traveled the country urging blind people to join the Federation. He organized new affiliates in states that had none. He took a job at the California Orientation Center for Blind Adults and began experimenting with new methods. He and Dr. Tenbroek soon devised a plan. It was to find a state program for the blind with a vacancy for director, one that was terrible, one where no one else wanted the job, one that might hire a blind person associated with the Federation, one where Federation ideas about blindness could at last be put to the test. The perfect chance came in 1958. The Iowa Commission for the Blind was looking for a director. The state agency fit the bill almost perfectly. The budget was minuscule, $20,000. The staff numbered six. The office consisted of three small rooms in a condemned building. It ranked last in the nation in rehabilitation. And most importantly, there was no long line of candidates seeking the job. Exactly the right profile he and Dr. Tenbrook had been looking for. The rest, as the saying goes, is history. Perhaps the remarks made in connection with the presentation of a citation from the President of the United States in 1968, just 10 years later, best sums up the significance of what came to be known as the Iowa experiment. The citation said, "If a person must be blind, it is better to be blind in Iowa than in any other place in the nation or the world." The Colorado Center for the Blind and our centers in Louisiana and Minnesota are the living legacy of Dr. Jernigan's work in Iowa. And of course, BISM too has been influenced by what happened in Iowa. So precisely what did happen in Iowa? Simply put, for the first time ever, a government agency for the blind began to design and deliver its services based on the belief that blind people can live the lives they want to live, that blindness is not what holds them back. Sound familiar? Today it does. Today it does. But back then, it was nearly universally regarded as a cruel and irresponsible hoax. Here's how it went. Dr. Jernigan might say to a new student, "What kind of job would you like?" The student might answer, "Perhaps I could be a piano tuner." To which Dr. Jernigan would reply, "Okay, sure, but what would you really like to do if blindness were not the issue?" Although framed a bit more politely than this, the gist of many a response was, "What kind of an idiot are you? Of course blindness is the issue." And then the real training would begin. Braille classes, mobility training, daily living skills, typing — it would be called keyboarding today — standard fare for training centers then and now. But what was not standard fare was the key ingredient of the training, the long process of convincing the student that Dr. Jernigan really was not an idiot after all, that blindness really was not the issue. Doesn't this sound a bit like blindness is not the characteristic that defines you or your future? Every aspect of training at the Iowa Center converged around this concept. Solid skill training and alternative techniques used by blind people combined with equally rigorous exploration of the misconceptions and stereotypes about blindness embedded in the very fabric of our society and perpetuated the most by professionals in the blindness field. Soon, unsurprisingly to Dr. Jernigan, but shocking to almost everybody else, graduates of the Iowa Center began to have careers as electrical engineers, lawyers, elementary school teachers, machinists, stockbrokers, and a host of other things. One could say they began to live the lives they wanted, that blindness was not what was holding them back. All right, we've gotten to about 1968, but I think I'm going to leave a few things here. Let me go on to say that the ideas were controversial. They also threatened many of the established agencies and professionals in the blindness field. and it was inevitable that the decade of the 70s would be one of confrontation. Dr. Jernigan had become president of the Federation when Dr. Tenbruck died in 1968. The overwhelming success of the new methods he pioneered in Iowa, coupled with the steady growth of the Federation, was being sharply felt by the old order. There were desperate attempts to preserve the status quo through a system of accreditation called NAC, which deliberately excluded the blind from any meaningful participation in the establishment of standards. Although the message was cloaked in the language of standards and accreditation, it was crude and it was ugly. We are the experts. We know what you need. We make the rules. You have no place at this table. We have the power to keep you out. Now, Dr. Jernigan's response was direct and it was forceful. You have it backwards. These are our lives. This is our time. We will be heard. Your power is crumbling. Your desperation cannot save you. There were vicious attacks on the Federation and on the Iowa programs and on Dr. Jernigan. It was a hard time for the Federation and for Dr. Jernigan personally. It is not pleasant to be the subject of false accusations in the newspaper day after day, to see the most successful programs for the blind in existence torn apart, to be the subject of a spurious, politically motivated criminal investigation instigated by a United States attorney seeking the publicity of a high-profile case to bolster her desire to become governor. It would have been an easy time for Dr. Jernigan to lower his profile, trim his sails, and simply wait for the controversy to subside. Instead, when the Federation appeared to be on the brink of financial disaster because of the unceasing public attacks, he took decisive action to move the organization forward in new directions. The 1978 establishment of the National Center for the Blind, now the Jernigan Institute, was a critical juncture for the organization. It was an act of faith that called forth the collective longing of the blind to take charge of their own destiny, and you know what we've done with that. It was a bold step, one that propelled the Federation forward toward its full maturity as the dominant force in matters relating to blindness in the country and in the world. And Dr. Jernigan, like Dr. Tenbruck before him, did another critical thing for us and for our future. Like Dr. Tenbruck, Dr. Jernigan looked around and he found the man who was going to carry forward after he was no longer president. And as a matter of fact, as many of you know, Dr. Jernigan stepped aside in 1986 and began working very closely with Dr. Maurer in his presidency. They had 12 years working together, and when Dr. Jernigan died in 1998, Dr. Maurer seamlessly stepped into full leadership and was ready to take over. We have a long history of looking ahead and being sure that this organization that we love will always be in good hands. And Dr. Maurer has done the same just this last summer. And I now turn it over to Mr. Riccobono, who will take part three.
Good afternoon. So, you know, the state president said, now, could you talk about Dr. Maurer at the convention? I said, well, sure, you know, he'll be there. And then I looked at the agenda, and I see it's at the end of the day. And, of course, Dr. Maurer is still here. And then she says, and besides that, can you also talk a little bit about the future? And I said, well, you know, he is the longest-standing president of the national... Anyway, how many of you know Mark Maurer? So that makes some of the job a little easier. And if you don't know him, he's still here. And I would encourage you to make the effort to get to know him. And I hope that you will get to know him in the way that I do, and to have the love and admiration and friendship that I have with him, and I know that many in this room do, because of the caring and thoughtful way in which he carries himself and invests in our organization. And I think that's a little bit instructive to what we've heard, where we're going, and the title of this presentation, which was given to us. We didn't coordinate that part. So a few things. I'm going to see if I can get this mic up here. All right, can you still hear me? Good. So I, like many people, first came to know our leaders through the writing that they did. And I first came to learn the caring and thoughtfulness in which Mark Maurer has put energy and imagination into our organization. Well, through the national convention in 1996 when I first heard him speak. But I came home from that convention and I read a speech that he presented in 1991 called Reflecting the Flame. And frankly, that's a piece I still go back to. And so I went back to it again. And a very apt quote that I think is also reflective of where we are today, partly because of these three giants, on the verge of our 75th year. So here's a quote from Reflecting the Flame. Our record of achievement during more than half a century will be remembered with pride. But it is only the prelude. Each generation must do for itself and build on the past. We have learned that lesson well. We have learned it from each other and from our own experience. In our yearning for freedom, others can go with us, but we must lead the way. We have not only reached but gone beyond the kindling point. We are the blind who reflect the flame. No organization on earth dealing with blindness has the strength, determination, or the spirit of the National Federation of the Blind. Well, you could say that that's true even today. We get to know our leaders through their writing. And so I wrote a letter to our national president after I read that speech shortly after my first national convention. And darn it if he didn't write me back. Now, I don't have time to share that letter with you, but there were some key things that were stated in that letter. From a guy who was trying to figure out his place and how blindness might impact his life. And the messages were these. Dr. Maurer expressed that he could teach me, but that he also expected that I would do some teaching of others. And that in teaching the ideas we had learned from each other, I would also be willing to share new ideas, because not all the great ideas had shown up yet. Another element that is expressed in our progress as a movement, and Mark Maurer as one of our great leaders, is the fact that because of where we were and who he is, his family truly has been part of our Federation family. Of course, we know Mrs. Maurer, who has been, absolutely, has been a cornerstone. And we got to know the Maurer children as they grew up through the Colonel books. And as someone who now is a blind father, one of the things that I learned reading those stories was that our leader was still discovering. And you can go back and read some of those stories about the things that even Dr. Maurer was discovering through his leadership in the Federation, but also through his work as a family man and trying to figure out whether blindness did or did not have an impact on his life. And in fact, those thoughts, those ideas, have inspired me to think about how I manage my own family. And I know that it has inspired many fathers and mothers in this room. Our mentor is willing to be a learner just as much as he has been willing to be a teacher. A few other things. He has modeled for us how to use all the tools in the toolbox, not just passing laws, but thinking about how do we make the laws better in the future. And you heard a technology presentation earlier that exhibited the spirit that we have gotten from Dr. Maurer. How do we take technology and get it to do what we want it to do, even though no one else believes that it can do that today? Because we believe in the people. We believe that blind people have capacity, and we can get technology then to do things that nobody else can imagine. And in relationships, Dr. Maurer has taught us not only that it is important to have a seat at the table, but frankly, he has taught us how to own every table we sit at. And that is balanced, with a responsible use of power. So when some people say, well, why are we worried about fair wages for all people? Aren't we concerned with the blind? The answer is yes, but it's the right thing to do, and that's responsible use of power. And that's what our mentor has taught us. Now, I have one other story to share, because I think it gets back to the title of this presentation. I got in the midst of being responsible for leading our blind driver project. And we had set up that we were going to drive, have a blind person drive a car at Daytona. And it was Dr. Maurer that even a decade before that was probably the only one that believed there was potential in this. And we set up a system to find the best blind driver we could. And in a chilly December in Virginia, we were testing this technology. And I wondered, isn't this a silly idea? Why are we competing to see who's the best blind driver? Mark Maurer is the only one who believed in this over a decade ago. But of course, that wouldn't be fulfilling the teachings of our mentor. That in fact, I have always learned from Mark Maurer that he expects us to teach. And that means pushing back and being part of the system. So had I failed to keep faith and do my best with that technology, I would have failed him and I would have failed the Federation. So I went out and whooped him. And there is a lot more to be said, but we are blessed that Mark Maurer is still here, and he will be with us and part of us and a leader of ours for a long time to come. And there's still more to be learned in his speeches. And if you look just at the titles of the last five banquet speeches, it points our way forward. And I'll leave you with one other thought, a thought that I think exemplifies Mark Maurer. And this summer at the convention, He talked to us about how he loves the history. But what he loves more is the history that we are about to make. And the fact of the matter is that our leaders are strong individuals with talent, but they do reflect the flame of blind people through the National Federation of the Blind. And that's why our leaders have led us to the place that we want to be. Because we reflect the flame, we continue to encourage and inspire each other to live the lives we want. Don't hesitate to get to know Mark Maurer and every leader of this organization, because we're in this together. Thank you.
Dr. Maurer would like 1 minute. We can give him one.
You got that?
Where's the FM? Mark's walking away.
He's taking it away. Yeah, I'll put it on. In order to be president of the National Federation of the Blind, a human being has to have an enormous ego. I have said many times that the Federation is going to determine what the future will be. And what I meant by that, in serving in the office that I have held, was that I would have the skill and the judgment to figure out how to get the right people to help determine what the future would be, and that I would help to direct that. Dr. Tenbrook had it. He had an enormous ego. Dr. Jernigan had it, and I have it. And when you're no longer president, your ego is no less. So I still have it. And I believe that our new president has it, and I think he needs it. Because you have to think in your heart that you have the judgment to know where we ought to go and to help lead people to learn about where we ought to be and how we ought to live. I think he's got it. I think he needs it. There is a need for a certain measure of humility as well, but you have to know when to do which. And I believe the president we have elected has the judgment to know how to decide which part of it to show most. I'm glad he has come to be our president, even though I still possess the ego that I had.